This is huge. I can tell you that human trafficking happens in every single country around the world. On any given day, there was 40 million people worldwide in a situation of modern slavery. So this is really significant.
Welcome to the Problematic Podcast, a show that gives you the chance to be the hero in helping solve some of the world's largest problems. Find out which teams need your skills today at problematic.app. And now, here's your host, Sean Tierney.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Problematic Podcast. I am your host, Sean Tierney, and today I am with Kyla Raby. Kyla works for the Australian Red Cross as head of a task force on human trafficking, forced labor, and forced marriage. She is a PhD candidate at the University of South Australia and has appeared on such radio shows and written articles for Radio Adelaide and theconversation.com. And I actually met Kyla in Medellin, Colombia when I was there with a program called Remote Year. Kyla, it's been 5 years. I'm excited to have you on the show. Welcome aboard.
Thanks so much, Sean. It's really lovely to see you again. And thanks for having me on the podcast.
For sure. Okay, so I figure the place to start here, because I've done some reading on this stuff, and there's a lot of terms thrown around. There's things like human trafficking and slave labor and domestic servitude and bonded labor and all these terms. Can you just kind of help us understand the landscape here? What is human trafficking? What does that mean?
Yeah, it's a great place to start. There is a lot of terminology in this space and it can get quite confusing about what we're talking about. So human trafficking is the term that is defined in law, in international law, that describes a situation where someone cannot leave because of coercion or deception or some form of control that another person has over them. And they've been put in that situation because they've been deceived or transported there through an element of force or deception. So it's quite a legally technical word, human trafficking, and it can refer to a whole range of different situations. So a lot of those terms that you just used, domestic servitude, you know, sexual trafficking, they are types of human trafficking and things that can be established in law as being human trafficking. But human trafficking is that kind of umbrella term for the legal definition of that practice. And it is quite specific, like the legal definition. So something that you might hear more commonly used now is the terminology modern slavery, because modern slavery is more of an umbrella term that again refers to a whole range of exploitative practices that generally those practices, what they have in common is, again, someone cannot leave a situation because of coercion or deception, and they've been put in that situation, again, because of, you know, that control that's been placed over them by somebody else. But modern slavery is not defined in international law like human trafficking is. So it's a lot more of a broadly used umbrella term to describe all of those types of exploitative practices.
Got it. And human trafficking or modern slavery does not necessarily mean transporting an individual to a new place. It can occur in the same location. It's really just that idea of coercion and against their will, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. So transport can be an element of human trafficking, but it doesn't have to be. You're exactly right. And when it does occur, when the transport does occur, it can happen across borders, but it can also happen within a country as well. So yeah, transport is quite a common element of human trafficking, but harboring, for example, so holding someone hostage is also an act, one of the components of the legal definition of human trafficking. So the actual transportation from one location to another does not need to occur for it to be human trafficking.
Got it. And scope-wise, what are we talking about here? I mean, you're from Australia, so I think your focus on this, I'm assuming, is within the context of Australia. But what, like, do you have any figures either locally or worldwide? What are we talking about? How many people does this affect?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is huge. I can tell you that human trafficking happens in every single country around the world. And in the latest statistics around kind of estimating the size of this global problem, and I should preface this by saying it's really hard to know just how significant this issue is, because there's a lot of reasons why it's underreported and why statistics and data is quite hard to estimate in this space. But the last and kind of one of the most, you know, reliable statistics is from the International Labour Organization, who said in 2016, on any given day, there was 40 million people worldwide in a situation of modern slavery. So this is really significant and affects every single country, including Australia, where you are right now in Lisbon, US, but it does affect different countries on different scales. So there's a lot of reasons why it may be more common in particular context than in others.
Where are the hotspots for this? Like, are there certain epicenters of where this is occurring more than other places?
Yeah, so there's like I was saying, there's a lot of reasons what might make human trafficking and slavery more common. Some of those things are when there's a conflict. So, for example, right now you might have been seeing headlines coming out of Ukraine that, you know, with 5 million people being forcibly displaced from their homes and from Ukraine, there is a significant amount of people, you know, who are in unstable situations and who are, as a result, very susceptible to human traffickers. So human trafficking is really a significant risk for people fleeing Ukraine right now and any conflict around the world, as well as disaster situations. You know, climate change is a huge driver of migration, which is also, of course, increasing the risk to human trafficking. And also, you know, we see that root causes of human trafficking involve poverty and lack of opportunity. So where there is countries and situations where there is, you know, very little opportunity for people to make a livelihood for themselves and to sustain themselves, then human trafficking risks usually. And also we know that migrant workers are at much higher risk of exploitation. So anyone working outside of their country of origin, generally, you know, there's a high risk of exploitation. So we see countries where there's lots of migrant workers and where that might be the case.
Got it. So situations where there's a lot of vulnerability, a lot of conflict and change, and these are natural kind of hotspots for this type of thing to occur more prevalently, it sounds like.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Let me ask you, so we quantity wise, 14 million people globally affected by this. Quality wise, what are we talking in terms? Sorry.
40, 40, my apologies.
Oh. 40 million. Wow. Okay. So massive issue in terms of the people, the reach here, but quality wise, like these are human rights abuses. What are the impacts, like the psychological damage of this, or like what, I'm assuming there's some kind of trauma element to it, but what is the repercussions of this occurring?
Absolutely. So as you mentioned in your intro, some of my work over the last 6 or 7 years has been directly with victims of human trafficking, both here in Australia and also in the UK. So I've seen firsthand, you know, the significant impacts that being in a situation of slavery or trafficking can have on someone. I think some of the most predominant impacts are the way that it destroys someone's trust in systems and in people and in relationships, because of that component of coercion and control that I mentioned in the definition. You know, you imagine if that you've been deceived and controlled, your ability to have a trusting relationship with someone in the future is really impacted. So we see a really wide range of psychological impacts that come from situations of slavery and the impacts of trauma, but also physical impacts. So, you know, if someone's been held in a situation of slave labor and they've been exploited for their labor, they may have a whole range of physical health issues that last for a very long time after their situation of trafficking has ended, or they've been able to leave that situation, that can go on and impact them for the rest of their lives. So, yeah, both physical, psychological impacts, economical impacts. So obviously, if you have been exploited for your labor, you haven't been earning an income or the income that you could have been earning for that period. So people are financially disadvantaged. There's a lot of issues even in countries like Australia in terms of accessing appropriate compensation for slavery. Even, you know, an alleged perpetrator has been found guilty, there's still issues with victims being able to actually access compensation for that financial reparation of harm. So yeah, I guess the impacts are really multidimensional and they can go on for a really long time, and they do require quite comprehensive systems of support in order to help someone address.
Okay, and I guess we should preface this that you're speaking as Kyla, the PhD candidate, not Kyla, the Red Cross worker. What can you say about, like, what types of work do you do? What are you actually doing day to day to help with this situation?
Yeah, thanks for that context as well, Sean. And look, I think So there's a range of different things that different organisations do. So organisations like the Red Cross in Australia, they do provide a whole range of services, like a comprehensive casework service is what Red Cross in Australia does. I used to work for the Red Cross in England as well many years ago, and they provided a range of different services to people who had been trafficked, such as, you know, for example, giving them information and access, enabling them to have access to legal advice in order to be able to make informed decisions about their own lives and what they wanted to do next. So there's a whole range of service providers out there. A lot of them are from the civil society, from the not-for-profit sector, so charities and NGOs doing this amazing work, and anything from, yeah, individual case management to support to awareness raising, advocacy. In my PhD, I'm really focused more on the presence of modern slavery in corporate supply chains and operations. So there's a lot of organisations that are doing some great work around, you know, trying to engage consumers and educate consumers about the presence of modern slavery in the products and the services that they consume on a daily basis. So you might have seen campaigns like Oxfam. They run a campaign called What She Makes, and it's all about, you know, the living wage or the lack of a living wage that women in the fast fashion sector make. So there's a bunch of, yeah, really, really great work being done. Does that answer your question? Sorry, not very specific.
No. Well, so I think it's helpful to think about this. It sounds like you're doing both on the preventative side of things with awareness and trying to diminish the problem, but then also recognizing that this is already occurring. And so you're also working to help the current victims of it, help them turn their lives around, how to recover from it, deal with some of these psychological conditions. That's really awesome.
Yeah, and my work in this area first started because I've been working with refugees and asylum seekers for the best part of the last 10 years. And we were seeing human trafficking, you know, along these migration routes, as I was mentioning, in the UK with the Syrian refugee crisis. We're seeing a lot of people coming to the UK that had been trafficked. So I started working in the area of human trafficking quite naturally in that victim support space, so in supporting people directly. And then, like you say, my research and my PhD interest has come from wanting to try to tackle the issue at a much broader systemic way and looking at it from a completely different angle, you know, in that corporate supply chain and consumer space.
You guys had a bill, I was reading in some of my research, I came across it, it was the Modern Slavery Act. This seemingly attempt to address it, not so much from like a micromanagement regulatory stance, but it seemed like it was trying to take more of an economic, like make it transparent, make people shamed, and, you know, have that be the thing, like kind of grassroots driven, that the consumer would then decide. As best I can tell, that hasn't played out in a productive way. Can you comment on just like the effectiveness or ineffectiveness of that bill?
Yeah, for sure. So this is really the area of my PhD research. And the Modern Slavery Act that Australia has came in 2019. But actually back in 2010, California in the US, in your home country, was the first kind of jurisdiction globally to introduce this type of legislation. So basically, you know, the state of California said, look, we're really concerned. Modern slavery is in so many of the products and services that California citizens consume every day. And we want to help consumers make better decisions about which businesses they support. So they introduced this legislation that mandated corporations, California corporations that earned over a certain revenue threshold, that they had to report and make a public statement once a year about what they were doing to reduce modern slavery in their supply chains. A few years later, in 2015, the UK introduced similar legislation. So they have their own Modern Slavery Act, and then Australia was the latest one to kind of pick up on this trend of legislating in this way and trying to address the issue of corporate accountability for modern slavery through this idea of transparency and promoting, you know, business transparency for consumers to then use and make better purchasing decisions. So that's kind of, you know, in a nutshell, the theory behind quite complex legislation. But my PhD research is really looking at why that theory doesn't work in relation to empowering consumers. And there's lots and lots of different reasons why the legislation in general isn't working. There's been quite consistent criticism from academics, from corporates themselves, from civil society of all three pieces of legislation that they're not really effective at all in reducing modern slavery, in actually tackling the issue that we're all, you know, concerned about. So unfortunately, they have been proven within research and evidence to be really ineffective in actually addressing the core problem. But what I'm looking at is...
Well, so where is the breakdown in your opinion? You've dug into this pretty deeply, it sounds like. Is it in the reporting of it? Is it in the consumer not having that information at the point of sale so they can do anything about it? Like, where is the failure here?
Yeah, so I think the failure is in lots of different ways. One, it doesn't actually address the root causes of modern slavery. So I think if you want to tackle an issue, especially one the size of modern slavery, you have to look at the root causes. And, you know, forcing businesses to report on steps that they're taking to look for modern slavery in their supply chains and operations doesn't deal with the reasons why people are exploited in the first place and the reasons why businesses actually profit from that exploitation. So modern slavery is prolific in global supply chains. You know, it's heavily embedded into the systems of production and consumption that we have, you know, in a capitalist system. But the legislation does not look at tackling those root causes of that. It just mandates that businesses disclose certain information. So it, for example, in Australia, the legislation here, it doesn't even mandate that businesses have to do anything if they find modern slavery in their supply chain. It doesn't say, you know, a business needs to do X, Y, and Z if you find it. It just says you have to report about it. So I think it really puts an unfair expectation on the consumer, because it says that actually consumers are going to be the ones that hold businesses accountable, and they'll punish businesses if businesses do the wrong thing. You know, they'll start boycotting a business if they're using modern slavery in their supply chain. But it makes it almost really, really impossible for a consumer to know whether or not a business is using, you know, modern slavery in their supply chain because of what it mandates that they report on. I know that's
Yeah. So it sounds like they're putting the burden of enforcement on the consumer here. And yeah. To try and understand their position, I guess I can understand why, you know, powerful companies would lobby against that and why the politicians might cave to them. And it's a difficult thing maybe to enforce like that type of regulation. Like you basically have to go babysit all these companies now and make sure that they're doing the right thing. So part of me gets this idea of free market forces and put it out there in transparency and it'll write itself eventually because the consumers will demand good behavior. But it sounds like maybe the failure right now is it's just too much to ask, like for everyone to educate themselves and to actually, like, if you're going to buy a pair of shoes, the average person is probably not like looking into the annual reports of the company and reading their disclosure statement on human trafficking to make that decision of do they buy Adidas versus Nike. It sounds like, is that the issue?
Yeah, I think that's one of the issues for sure, like the unfair burden that it places on consumers. Because I think also we've got to remember that, you know, consumers are a very broad group of people, and those that have the time, the capacity and the resources to be ethical consumers are in the more privileged type of consumers. So, you know, people who are in a low socioeconomic bracket may not have the resources economically to even make a different consumption decision. So it's quite a privilege to be able to be an ethical consumer and to do your research and to make decisions based on things other than price, for example. So that's one thing to remember. But I think there's also a lot of flaws in the actual legislation in terms of what it forces businesses to disclose. So even if you were a very well-educated consumer, and I like to think that I am, and I've tried to do this where I've sat down and looked at modern slavery statements, and I've spent hours trawling over my favorite company's modern slavery statements, and I've studied this stuff for years now, and I've still walked away going, I really do not know if I should shop at this shop or this shop. Like, it is very confusing, you know. So the right information's not being disclosed. And supply chains, global supply chains, are very complex. So, for example, some, you know, in Australia, some businesses are really only looking at the first tier of their supply chain at the moment. And we know that exploitation and slavery type practices are happening much further down that supply chain. So you're looking at your, you know, your third and your fourth tier, but companies are not even at the point where they're mapping those later tiers in their supply chains yet. So you know, the idea is that this will happen over time, but we've also seen in California that that has not occurred. You know, that legislation's been in place for over 10 years now, and we're not seeing any significant change.
Is there the equivalent, you know how like in agriculture, you've got basically the little organic stamp and there's very specific criterion necessary to meet that and have that sticker on your produce. Is there something equivalent here? Is it fair trade or what is the stamp in the case of a product that guarantees that there was no, you know, human trafficking involved in that supply chain?
Yeah, it's a really great question, and I can see why that would be an appealing thing for a consumer. And, you know, fair trade is a label that probably so many people around the world are quite familiar with. It's one of the most recognisable labels that has an accreditation behind it. But basically any of those labels, there's now a whole range of different types of this private accreditation certification type schemes. That is one way of trying to regulate, you know, worker exploitation. There's also a lot of issues with that way though, because often it may involve self-regulation from corporates. So some certification schemes, for example, have an independent oversight mechanism, which is fantastic. How well that independent oversight mechanism can function is questionable. And also some don't. It's up to the corporate to meet the standards and to say that they meet those standards themselves. So whether or not, you know, you trust that, and if there's no independent oversight. So unfortunately, there's kind of like no one amazing certification scheme. And some of the research that I've been looking at in my PhD so far, it shows that actually in some of these certification schemes, because consumers are more likely to purchase and support that brand, there's actually less due diligence that corporates are doing to ensure that there's no slavery in their supply chain. So it can actually, you know, work in the opposite way, where there's more slavery present in some of those, you know, farms that have that certification versus a farm that doesn't, for example. So it can be very, again, deceiving for consumers and very confusing for consumers to know which certifications to trust and which ones not to.
Yeah, well, and it seems like this is yet another failure point given how the incentives are structured here. There's perverse incentives for the company to not do super deep investigation. Like it's in their interest to not turn over the rock that reveals, oh no, we do have some of this occurring in our supply chain. So I can see how like it's very much kind of do the bare minimum and yeah, it looks like we're good and here's our disclosure statement, but it's not really vetted. And especially if there is no teeth to this regulation, then no one's questioning on that. Yeah.
And in Australia as well, our legislation, there's no penalties. So if you don't report or if you report false or misleading information at the moment, there is no penalty, no financial or criminal or civil penalty that can come for you. So there's actually even no incentives to do this work really well for corporates. And going back to the whole kind of framework of the legislation, you know, corporates exist to make profit, and you know, they will operate in a way that makes that maximizes that profit for their shareholders. When we're talking about work well-being and exploitation, it's when profit margins are squeezed, which is the natural inclination of business, that, you know, the bottom line is that the worker is the one that's losing out. So it's, yeah, a very natural function for business to look for opportunities to squeeze that profit margin. And that's often what puts people at higher risk of exploitation.
Got it. Is there, it reminds me of in employment, there's this site called Glassdoor, which is kind of a check and balance on employers. It's this vent. It's a way for people to anonymously report malfeasance. And you end up with kind of this, like, I think of almost like Carfax. You can go and see the history and get firsthand opinions of wrongdoings and things that have occurred in companies. I almost wonder, is there some equivalent that could be built here, or is there already exists this service where you can kind of go and see like where does the average person report, you know, issues here, and is it publicly available in some way?
Yeah, it's a great question, Sean. And I don't know if this app exists outside of Australia. I'm sorry, but we have an app here called Good On You, and it's a really great example of kind of a tech based solution. What you're talking about with the Glassdoor example, where you can look up a product and it gives you a background and a scorecard as to that corporate's, you know, behaviour, not just in relation to modern slavery, but in relation to a whole range of different things. You know, the impact on the environment. You know, whether or not they market, for example, if it's a liquor company, whether or not they market to teenagers and children or not. So even their marketing practices and their ethical approach to a whole range of different things. So I think that's a great contribution to this overall solution. And it can certainly help to inform consumers about some of those decisions. And I use some of those tools in my everyday life because it does get very overwhelming when you're so aware of all of the presence of slavery in everything they purchase. But I also think that part of the solution is around reducing consumption, because we live in such an consuming world. And yeah, I think sometimes the solutions that just promote an alternative to consumption are also part of the problem.
Yeah, for sure. I don't disagree at all. I think it's a very difficult thing to change human behavior, like the natural inclination to consumption. I think it's a noble goal. But I think what I would look for, and we're now kind of wading into the solutions territory, which is fine, but as an overall goal, like, what are those high leverage things that we can realistically envision that they could work and they could occur? Kind of just, if you're new listening to this podcast, kind of what makes this different maybe than the ordinary podcast that you're used to is there's an active component here. The hope is, and perhaps a hallucination, but a hope is that some people are listening, and maybe that one person who hears some of what we're talking about in terms of how this problem is working, has a great idea. We are striving to give the platform that enables the collaboration and execution on that idea. And so, Kyla, like, let me ask you this, like, you've been so deep in the weeds with all this stuff. If you could transport yourself forward, let's say, a year or 5 years or whatever it is, wave a magic wand and the ideal solution exists, what does that look like? Whether it's regulatory, whether it's some app or consumer driven, or like what could be built? Can you imagine anything being built that could actually put a dent in this issue? And what does that look like?
Oh, it's such a tough question, but I love it. I say if I could fast forward to 5 years, the things that I would change is I would make the Australian Modern Slavery Act itself. I would make a lot of changes to that to make it a much stronger example of government regulating corporate behavior, because I really am of the perspective that it is the role of government to regulate corporates and multinational corporations, and that responsibility shouldn't be on the consumer to make sure that they're supporting the right businesses. So I would change the legislation. However, I do also see that there is an amazing role that consumers can play in trying to influence change. And I think, I'm a big believer whether we're talking about climate change or, whatever kind of big global issue we're discussing, that individual impact can also collectively be, incredibly transformative. So I think in terms of what could be built and what could exist, I think because of the Modern Slavery Act, there is a lot of information that's being disclosed by businesses. And if there was some kind of tech platform or something that made that information translatable to consumers in a really easy way, and that allowed them to use that in their everyday purchasing decisions, that could certainly help meet some of that intention around empowering ethical consumerism. I think that app could also, it could track reports of bond slavery that are not made by businesses, because we know that what businesses are disclosing themselves is only one side of the story. And there's so much more information out there, investigative reporting, research reports that are coming from different institutions and think tanks and academics. So if it could consolidate all of the information around, okay, where are the modern slavery risks? And, where, for example, high-risk products right now, we know through the last 2 years going through COVID that PPE, masks and rubber gloves coming from Malaysia are really at high risk of being made with forced labour. So if it could translate all of that information and put it in a way that was digestible for consumers, that could be amazing.
Well, I saw in my research, I came across the Department of Labour's list of goods. And so they've got like this registry of, it sounds like, known, violators. So goods, yeah, in other words, that clearly are made. So it sounds like maybe just making that more accessible at the point of sale. Like, if there's something easy enough where literally it's an app on your phone, you scan the SKU barcode and it tells you percentage likelihood that there's like human trafficking involved in the production of this good, gives you some kind of score. And then you can, as a consumer, you can vote with your wallet and say, hey, you know what? I'll pay the $5 extra to go get this other thing because it looks like this is pretty clearly implicated. Something, it sounds like, it's just pushing it to the edges and making a little bit more frictionless and a little bit more accessible for the average person. It sounds like that might be a really big win.
I love that. And I think what could make that even better is if at the same time, by a press of a button in an app, you could email that corporate, you know, the business that you're not purchasing from and say, hey, I care that you have soft slavery in your supply chains. You know, you need to stop, because I think that communication between consumers and corporates, you know, it does have an impact if it's at a large scale. So, you know, or, you know, take solutions that can help that large scale consumer to corporate communication, and also to our politicians. So the list that you're talking about, you know, is a really great example. The US actually has some other really good examples of legislative initiatives that are trying to prevent modern slavery in supply chains. So like that, this top 100 product risk, but also they have a lot of import restrictions. So the US just only last month introduced a really amazing piece of legislation that is restricting imports of products that have been made in the Xinjiang region of China, where there's a lot of evidence of forced labor and mass genocide, essentially, of the Uyghur population there. So I think, yeah, there's so much information resources, like you say, already there. It's just about getting that into the hands of people who can use it on a mass scale.
Yeah, for sure. And I like that it's not just voting with your wallet, but then also the other side of that, the carrot and the stick or whatever, it's basically telling the company, hey, I'm not buying your product. I'm going to go buy this competitor's product, and here's why. And that just closes the loop on like forcing them. It's now not altruism. It's like financial incentive, profit wise. Like they need to change their behavior because they just lost a sale. I think that's making Absolutely. It very real to the business.
And then telling your local politicians that this is an issue that you care about. And I think because here in Australia, last year we had an attempt from one side of politics, from some of our independent politicians, to introduce similar legislation to the bill that I was just talking about that the US have just introduced, the banning goods being made from Xinjiang in China. And unfortunately, it didn't pass in Australia, like the legislation didn't go through because our government said, oh, we've got the Modern Slavery Act and that's enough. And they're so fundamentally different pieces of legislation in the way they work. And the Modern Slavery Act does not ban goods that have been made with forced labour from coming into the country. You know, it does very far from that. So I think unless our politicians know that, you know, their constituents and their citizens really care about these issues and they want more action taken about it, it's very easy for governments to say, you know, it's okay, we're doing this. The problem solved. So I think, yeah, voting with your wallet, but also being a conscious citizen and a really engaged, active citizen through communicating with our political systems, as much as so many of us might be quite disenfranchised by them in particular in the last few years. They still are, you know, there to establish systems of governance that, you know, having big impacts on all of these issues. So if we can communicate with them and try and influence them in some way, I think that's helpful too.
Yeah, I would never tell someone not to engage politically and not to care about this and vote. But to me, it's also like, if governments wanted to solve this, they would have solved this by now. I just don't think waiting around for legislation to come that cures this is not really, at least, the spirit of this podcast. We're far more about like, how do we get scrappy? What's the vigilante, you know, app we can build that actually tackles this problem and puts a dent in it today? And it sounds like I think closing the loop economically, making it economically non-viable for companies to engage in this bad behavior is the answer. And then the question is, okay, how do we do that? Like it each point of the system here in the supply chain, what is the high leverage choke point that we can focus in on and say, okay, getting in front of the consumer at the point of sale, empowering them with the information so they can make the decision. And we know that, like you said earlier, you know, you're not going to get everyone. Like I don't know what it's like in Australia, but like in the US, you go into a Walmart and, you know, 90% of the people there, I don't think are at the place financially where they can even have the luxury to start to make, you know, decisions like this and pay the extra $5 for the thing that is known to not have human trafficking. So we're not going to move everyone, exactly. But what we're focused on that portion of the population who does have the luxury and just doesn't have the awareness or the accessibility of this information to actually make a good informed decision. I think that's who we're trying to move.
Yeah, and I completely agree. I think that's a great approach, but I do think that the majority of consumers are probably in that space where the luxury to make decisions are outside of their control. And so that's why I think a multi-pronged approach in terms of, you know, forcing or trying to influence our governments to actually legislate on this properly helps the situation. But to what you said at the beginning of just this section we're talking about now is that corporates will listen to profit. That's what's going to be the most important thing to them. And so if whatever solution that we can come up with that impacts their profit or puts at risk their profit, I think that will be an effective one.
For sure. I came across a tool. I don't know if you've run across this, but it was called the Responsible Sourcing Tool. And it seemed to be like a B2B. We've been talking more about the consumer side of things, but this seemed to be more like the B2B equivalent of someone what they could use to inspect their own supply chain and unearth any kind of wrongdoing here. We can link to this in the show notes for anyone listening. If you're in a company, that might be something interesting to apply to your own supply chain and look at it. Are there any other tools or sites or, you know, for someone who wants to educate themselves further on this stuff, what resources do you recommend?
Oh, great. Another great question. I think there's so many great resources out there now for businesses who are doing this work and who are at the early stages of this work. So I probably won't mention any of them because there's just so many. And if you are a business, you know, definitely reach and you're struggling with this, you know, just start looking into who can support you because there's quite a lot. I think for consumers, I would say go to Good On You. So I can give you that link as well if you want to pop that in the show notes. Yep. Even if it's not going to apply to the brands in your country, in your particular country, I think it's a really good example of, you know, something that can help consumers make decisions. But I would also just say to start with some of the basic overview of this issue. So to look at, for example, the International Labour Organization and some of the UN agencies. And I know your framework in Problematic, Sean, looks at the Sustainable Development Goals. So SDG 8.7 is all about eliminating forced labour and modern slavery. So there's an organization called Alliance 8.7, which is a collective of academics, organizations, state governments, a whole range of different actors that are working together to look at how to advance that goal of eliminating modern slavery. So Alliance 8.7 is a really good one. And they also do a lot of research and evidence-based initiatives to try to track the impact of various different interventions that are designed to address these problems. So I think that's a really good one as well.
Nice. We'll link all that. There's also another one I ran across, Polaris Project, which seemed like a kind of a more stay in touch. They have a newsletter, it looks like, and it's really just educating you on the latest developments in this whole space. So we'll link all this stuff in the show notes for the people that want to kind of do a little more digging. Like Kyla said, there appears to be just a ton of information out there. And I think the danger of that is that then people feel overwhelmed and they do nothing. So I kind of want to tee it up and just elevate the highest priority, best sources to give people, you know, maybe if you're going to read three things and you have 10 minutes, what do you go educate yourself on? And so we'll try to do some of that curation and link to those in the show notes. Kyla, I think this is probably a good place to wrap it up. Where do you, like, if people want to connect with you or stay in touch and like monitor what you're doing, watch your thesis, your PhD that comes out, like how do people stay in touch?
I wouldn't put your listeners through that grief of reading an 80,000 word thesis. But have very, very happy to connect with anyone interested in this topic. As you can probably tell, it's something I'm really passionate about. So always love having a chat and discussing different things in relation to this. So LinkedIn is probably my best way of getting in touch. And I'm also on Twitter. You can feel free to share those links as well if you like. Sean, I can give them to you afterwards. And I would just say as well, I completely agree with what you were just mentioning about not wanting to overwhelm people, because this can be a really, really overwhelming issue. And, you know, one thing I always like to leave people with is just if there's something that you can do, you know, three very basic things that you can do to have a big impact in the space is educate yourself. So just to learn and, as you say, engage with those resources, learn more about the topic. And a second one is to educate someone else. So to share what you've learned, you know, and your knowledge through social media, your friends, friends, family, have conversations. And then the third thing is, you know, to consume less. So to just try next time, you know, you're looking for something, you know, a new outfit to buy on the weekend, just think about if you can go to your local charity op shop or borrow something from a friend, because I do think that's a very big thing that everyone can do to have a big impact on reducing some of the systemic issues in modern slavery and supply chains.
Nice. I actually did just think of one more question I meant to ask you. And that is, I saw an article published years ago and it said, drowning doesn't look like drowning. And I read it and it was the idea of recognizing when drowning is occurring and that, you know, it's just giving the average human awareness when they see someone out in the ocean, realizing that, oh, like, it doesn't look like drowning. This is what it looks like. In this context, is there a way to recognize just a victim of this? Like, do they have certain characteristics or traits, or is there anything you look for in interaction daily, like where someone could report if they discovered, like, hey, this looks suspect, like I think this person is a victim? What are we looking for? What are the signs there?
Yes, I'm so glad you asked. Thanks, Sean, because you're right. Like, we've been focusing mainly on talking about it in, you know, abstract in terms of supply chains and quite far removed from a consumer. However, it happens in our communities every day. And so there is a likelihood that as, you know, just a member of any community that you may come across modern slavery. So really common indicators to look out for is any signs that somebody may not have control of their own personal situation. So, for example, a migrant worker who doesn't have their passport or doesn't know, you know, much about their surroundings, so doesn't know their address or where they live. We often see frontline healthcare workers or, you know, even just staff in community centres and frontline roles when they engage with someone who doesn't have access to their identity documents or doesn't know much about where they're living. That's a really good indicator that they've been controlled or coerced and perhaps not connected into their community. You know, if someone's been constantly accompanied by another person, then that could be an indicator. It doesn't always have to be, because also psychological control is a big part of it. Doesn't have to be that physical control of somebody else actually being with someone, but we also see if someone owes a big debt to someone. So debt bondage is a technique used to control someone, so they might be constantly paying someone back this inflated debt. Or, you know, also if physical signs that someone's actually been abused. So that there's a whole range of different indicators. On their own, they don't necessarily mean human trafficking, but as you say, if keeping an eye out for them, looking for them, and just noticing when something feels a bit off. One of the things I've tend to do now in my life is that whenever I encounter a migrant worker, I have a conversation with them, and I just like to have a bit of a chat and just see, ask them a few questions and just be friendly and nice. And I sometimes feel, I'm doing a bit of a modern slavery assessment here, but actually also you're just connecting with someone who might be new to the country and could really appreciate just a friendly face and a smile. So, you know, that's something that everyone can do as well, just having more conversations with strangers. And I think we've probably gone a really long way away from that in our more individualized society now. So trying to get back to that, connecting with strangers and in particular migrant workers because of their high risk of modern slavery.
I think it's a great, great place to end. Not being heads down in the phone so much, looking up once in a while, maybe talking to someone that you wouldn't ordinarily talk to. And if these signs come up, then obviously probe a little deeper. But great advice. Kyla, thank you so much for the work you do. Thanks for taking the time today. It's been a pleasure to have you on.
No worries. Thanks so much for having me. And thanks to your listeners for tuning in. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to the Problematic Podcast. To get involved and propose a project idea of your own, or to join in the discussion around one of the projects proposed during the show, visit problematic.app. That's problem, ATTIC.app. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts and leave a rating and review on your favorite platform. Until next time, be the change.